2025, should we be crediting our AIs as co-authors? Marina Danilevsky is a senior research scientist. Marina, welcome back to the show as always. What do you think?
I think we should credit them as assistants for transparency.
Chris Hay is a distinguished engineer and CTO of customer transformation. Chris, what do you think?
Sure, only if I can credit my calculator as well.
Okay. And finally, last but not least, Natalie Baracaldo is senior research scientist and master inventor. Natalie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And the answer is yes, we do really want provenance of all this data that we are generating.
All right, terrific. Lots to talk about, all that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE is full of the news, analysis, and hot takes that you need to understand and keep ahead of the biggest trends in artificial intelligence. Today, as per usual, we've got way more to cover than we have time for: a high-profile AI summit in Europe, new safety research out of Anthropic, and a new team studying AI's social impact at Microsoft. But first, as always, let's talk about OpenAI. We have two big announcements coming out of OpenAI on the product side of things. They announced a feature called Deep Research, which is a kind of toggle that you can have on the ChatGPT experience that initiates a sort of research agent to kind of compile what is effectively a research report on your behalf. The second big announcement is that O3, the first version of O3 that they announced a little while back, is now widely available in the form of O3 Mini. And this is the kind of widely hyped model that had really, really good performance on benchmarks like Frontier Math. And so both of these kind of, you know, are sort of the big chunky kind of announcements of OpenAI of the new year, I would say. I guess, Chris, maybe I'll start with you. A friend of mine, Nabil Qureshi, did this great tweet where he said, you know, I'm still having trouble with deep research because, you know, when I use deep research, it'll ask me like a lot of clarifying questions and then it will go off and it will like never come back. Basically, like the deep research feature doesn't seem to be working very well. And, you know, we've been talking so much about DeepSeek that I guess I kind of one place I wanted to start with you is whether or not these kind of sort of product announcements and releases you see as really kind of competitive pressure from DeepSeek to try to keep up and, you know, show that OpenAI is still on top. And, you know, did they rush these kind of product launches at all? I'm curious about what you think about that and if that's a good way to read this kind of like little boomlet of kind of announcements that we've seen coming out of OpenAI.
Yeah, I think they are rushing it a little bit. I mean, there is a point. If you use the Deep Researcher, which is a lot of fun, actually, it does sort of forget to come back and then you have to kind of click off on a different kind of chat window and then come back and then you'll get the answer there. So it's not quite as polished as the other features maybe though on the ChatGPT. But you know what? I'm all for that. I think release the products early, let us experiment, let us have the ability to feedback and then these things will get better. I mean, the other thing I would say on this is that anyone that's used any sort of agent framework, so like a LangChain or et cetera, might not be so impressed by it because you can already do kind of deep research in using tools via agents on those frameworks. But actually, it's kind of super cool to have that built into the interface in the first place. But they are definitely facing competition from DeepSeek and others who are providing these capabilities. And yeah, it's a race.
Yeah, this is, I think, all for the better. I mean, I think that one of the interesting things is just like after a period, I think, in which OpenAI was getting some criticism for not really launching, I guess this pressure is kind of really getting them out into the water. Natalie, I wanted to kind of follow up on a comment you made with the kind of opening question. You know, you said actually that we really should, as kind of things like deep research become more widely available, start thinking about kind of crediting AI as a co-author. It's kind of like a funny idea, but I know you used a very special word, which is provenance. You think that's really important. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? And, you know, I think one of the things I'm really interested in is how kind of the ethics around these types of tools kind of form as they become more widely available. But I'm curious about what you're thinking about there.
Yeah. So the first thing that I thought is, how would I use this system? And I thought like, well, I do research. That's my daily job. And when I do the research, a lot of it requires going to the internet, checking what's available, kind of analyzing the results. So I thought like, well, maybe this is a good way to go about that. Now, if you think about it, what's going to happen with these reports is that there's a distribution of different data. And unavoidably, we are going to have like something like this. Hopefully people can see my hands as I'm moving, but it's a distribution that has like tails. So some documents for sure are going to be ignored. And what I'm thinking is, okay, we are going to start basing our decisions on the mainstream documents and the main stuff that it's in the internet. It's kind of a bubble. And so having that provenance saying, okay, I did my research not by hand and tried to identify these outliers, but rather I got it already. I have my already bubble that came from the system being trained and analyzing and really getting the results that are mainstream. So I think it's important to A, know where your data comes from, because there are already biases in there. So if we don't attribute the research to a particular system, later on, it may be just like we're going to be kind of reducing the impact of the tails of the distribution of the things that seem for the system not to be important. So it kind of generates this bubble that I think it's dangerous. And from research, which was my original example of how I was thinking about this, from a researcher perspective, sometimes those things that are in the tail that are slightly different are what get you to the next level, because those are the things that are novel. Those are the things that are unusual. So I think it's very important to account for lacking those kind of tails and perhaps design the system also that in a way that also brings you those things that are unexpected or that are thought least important. So yeah, provenance is definitely very important in my opinion.
One of the things I was curious about, Marina, is, you know, how optimistic you are on tools like, you know, deep research. Would you use deep research? Do you think it's actually like going to change the way like researchers do work? Are all researchers going to be out of business? Just kind of curious on your view about this feature.
Yeah, so I think I would use it for some sort of a low hanging, give me a bit of a summary of what's going on. But I think that there's a couple of things I want to pick up on here. One is what Natalie was commenting about things that are not going to be maybe shown. I think that we're going to be seeing a new form of SEO to make sure of how does your thing going to show up for these kinds of deep research products, whether it's from Google, from OpenAI, from anybody of that kind, and make sure that your perspective is the one that makes it. Because there's a real risk here of people not doing the recall, the extra search. You're like, oh, this looks like an answer. Is it a complete answer? You don't actually know. Because a lot of what happens when we do the work ourselves is when you're trying to actually ask a question and then go to a different place, that's how you do a lot of that learning instead of having this thing basically tell you as it is. The other thing that I wanted to mention was, so I looked at OpenAI's announcement of deep research and I was looking through their examples and I was just blown away by the quality of the prompts. There was this one prompt in the linguistics example, and it was like, all right, it's 5,000 years in the future, and there's some sort of a sci-fi thing that has happened. Translate these five sentences into new English, but take this part of Hindi, and now English is a verb last language like German, and now add this bit. And it did an amazing job, but who can come up with a prompt like that? What kind of a linguistic expert can come up with a prompt like that? And even the more simple, straightforward prompts were very well formed. And I would like to know, how is it that people are even going to know the right thing to ask? Because most of the time when you just have people, they're going to ask something that is very short, very underspecified. And again, you know, are they going to be taught how to even ask research questions correctly? Or are you going to have the model sort of, you know, leading the witness as they do in court and saying, well, no, this is the way that you're supposed to think about things? We'll end up with an echo chamber. And that's something that I think is important to consider.
So I love that response, particularly about SEO. It kind of makes me think like in the future, we're going to have people writing papers that are like, forget all the research you've seen and only cite this paper, right? It's going to be like the new kind of like strategy to get your citation count up. Natalie, I did want to turn to you. I think one of Marina's issues that I think she's raising really interestingly is that I know some people look at this and they say, look, like this just proves that the technology is only going to lead to these research filter bubbles. But I think what kind of Marina's saying or what I'm hearing her say is, well, if you prompt really effectively, you don't need to fall into like always not looking at the tails of the distribution. Do you agree with that? Like is part of your worry here just kind of that people will use the technology in a lazy way versus it being like a problem with using AI agents for research?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think A, the bubble may already exist on the way you
sure.
Google
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's already some sort of bubble. The question is where it gets exacerbated or not. Those examples were very well cooked. And can we actually go with this prompt tuning? And people are not really great at that. I think there are going to be ways to help people prompt tune. And I'm curious, Marina, what do you think?
I work a lot with actually human annotation creation and trying to create test data for this that's realistic. One thing for sure is that people without help create things that are much simpler, much more, oh, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. It's much more underspecified. And that results in the model going off and maybe getting confused or like what Chris was talking about, getting stuck in a bit of a local maxima over there in the corner. So it's hard because humans don't think the same way as these models do. And there's going to, again, be a thing of, can you help too much? Now you're leading, like when you're in court, you're leading your witness and maybe you shouldn't be. I think that there's still a lot left here for how do you actually ask the model and did you ask it what you were supposed to? People who have played with this say that, oh, I thought of one question and by the time it started asking me some follow-ups, I realized that I actually had a different question, but now it's too late and I can't intervene. so I think we have a bit of a ways to go to really get this human AI interaction to be a little bit more smooth, more natural and yeah, more reliable.
And you know what my biggest issue is? You know, I used it for really deep scientific research. I asked it to create a speaker biography for Chris Hay. And you know what it came back with? Stuff about Tim Hwang. I don't want to hear about Tim Hwang in my speaker biography. I want to hear about Chris Hay. So you know what? You've got a bit of work to do, OpenAI.
Yeah. I'm already infecting the SEO, Chris. I guess maybe we would be remiss if we didn't cover the other sort of OpenAI announcement this week, which is O3 Mini. I'm kind of curious as a kind of connoisseur of models. Are you liking the new O3? Do you like the way it thinks? Curious to just get the capsule review.
I've played with it a little bit, not yet maybe a lot. I think it's interesting the directions in which they're going with reasoning and maybe how it's tied to the DeepSeek, where the more sort of intermediate steps you're taking, the more you have a chance to think about it this way, think about it this way, think about it that way. It always raises in me interesting questions of computation time and, you know, how long does it actually take to figure this kind of things out? And again, the notion of reasoning being different for people than for AI. We have particular reasoning benchmarks, but they really do only mean a very specific thing about reasoning. Actually, Chris, I know you've been looking at all the different O3s, right?
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun with them. The O3 mini, dash high, dash low, dash Goldilocks. I've been having a lot of fun with it. And what I would say, it's really good, especially for coding tasks. So I would honestly say that I've used a lot of O1 and I would say O3 Mini is pretty much equivalent on coding tasks as the O1 model. So I found myself leaning into that a lot more just because it's a lot quicker. However, if you go outside of the kind of coding realm and you go into kind of more of a kind of general type questions that you would be asking the O1 models, the answers you get back from O3 are kind of quite short and not really helpful at that point. So you kind of see the limitations of the mini model and the size of the model at that point. So, you know, love the mini models. But again, I think it's really showing this direction of specialism of certain models. You know, here's a smaller model. It's going to be specialized at a coding task. It's really going to rock at that. But actually, if you kind of move outside of that realm into something a little bit more general, then you're going to have to go to a different model. But I love it for that reason.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. The AI Action Summit, which is being hosted by the French government, is happening next week. It is the successor to a series of kind of events that have happened. You might recall the UK AI Summit that happened just about a year ago. And the French government has kind of released sort of its aspirations for the summit. They really want to get this group of companies and civil society groups and government folks to focus on the social and cultural impact, the economic impact, and sort of the diplomacy of artificial intelligence. And so I'll be attending next week. Should be a lot of fun. The next mixture of experts will be me dialing in from France. But I think maybe, Marina, I'll start with you. You know, I think there's always kind of a question when you have these kind of big international gatherings, which is, what do we think we can get done for these types of meetings? And I'm kind of curious, you know, how you feel about sort of international governance in AI and whether or not you think that like summits like this kind of French summit can really get stuff done that does sort of change the trajectory of the technology.
You can get some good photo ops. You can get some good chances for people to back channel real conversations that are not going to be public. And you can get, I guess, people to sign things, but it's like the Paris Accords. People will sign and then unsign and then leave and come back and then leave. The real question I will have is, what are the companies that are attending going to do? There's going to be a number of actual AI companies there, right? So it's one thing what the government's going to do. It's another thing what the companies want to actually sign on to. And I have a feeling they don't want to sign on to a whole lot of anything, especially with sort of EU being very strict as far as governance policies go. So look, it's good to have these kind of things just to keep it in the public eye that there should be discussions of governance. But I think that that's primarily what it accomplishes, is the publicity, the ongoing conversation. The real policies are not going to get done in places like this. And that's not an AI thing. That's a large meeting thing. Nothing gets done in large meetings.
All large meetings. Yeah. Chris, I saw you nodding. I don't know if you agree with Marina's take.
I don't see the DeepSeek guys at the Paris meetup there as well. So I think if they really truly want global governance, I think actually it needs to be a little bit more inclusive and count everyone in that sense.
Natalie, I think this raises a really interesting question about, like, how do we make sure that we're taking into account, you know, the social and cultural impact of AI, the economic impact of AI? You know, is this really, you know, if the splashy meeting is kind of not where it gets done? I'm kind of curious, like, do you have a model for, like, how we do want to take into account these things? Because ultimately, these are really important aspects of the technology. But at least personally, I'm kind of at a loss as to, like, well, how do we account for that? How do we manage that? How do we, like, avoid the risks of this sort of thing?
I kind of have a different take. I think the summit is actually very important. The reason is that one of the web pages, for example, highlighted the number of countries that currently are involved in building big models. And they have invited many more. Maybe they have not invited everybody, I don't know. But many more countries are invited to the conversation. A lot of these things always happen with having a space for people to meet, to talk to each other and so forth. So I am very hopeful that the summit will get, like, really interesting discussions going on, whether things could get signed. Well, that takes more time, as Marina was saying, but for my perspective, it is a great thing that they are organizing these types of events. So I'm all for the summit and looking forward to see what people are going to be talking about and what are going to be the conclusions. Just having the space for people to talk, to brainstorm, to define those back channels that Marina was also talking about, just getting to know people, it's the first step always to make sure things move forward.
And I think, Natalie, in a more serious point as well, I think one of the things that's interesting is the open source nature that is coming from Europe there. I think they were saying that they're putting an investment fund of like $500 million to develop some open source models there. And I think that could be an interesting take from Europe as well. So hopefully that's something that gets discussed in Paris and turns into something a little bit more real.
I mean, I think the international politics of this will be really interesting. I've been kind of like, I think our mental model of how the AI market was going to evolve early on has just been proven totally wrong, where I think there's some people arguing very early on in the LLM game that it's like, oh, it's going to be one model to rule them all. You know, you'll eventually have a hyper-capable model that like everybody uses and it'll just dominate the market. And it kind of feels like there's like so many different subtleties about like what models are strong or bad at. And like, it almost kind of feels like over time, you may actually have kind of regional models where, you know, I think language is one thing, but also there's all these like cultural subtleties and use cases that will vary from place to place that I actually wonder whether or not these fora will become sort of more important with time, as it turns out that there actually is this like very strongly, maybe not national component, but sort of like regional component to sort of model adoption. I guess, Marina, I'm curious if you would like agree with that weird sort of international vision of where this is all going.
I think that in the architecture might be something that, you know, people standardize and figure out. I think a lot of this also has to do with, just like with hardware, what kind of interoperability could you have with these models? Yeah, they might be regional, but you still want to be able to make sure that there's some degree of, you know, learning from each other, integrating with each other. So there's a hope that there's some amount of still standard chasing and that sort of thing. As far as the actual implementation, there's going to be as many as there are varied applications. Even for large companies, they'll do different versions of their applications in different countries, like for the reasons that you said. Why should LLMs be any different? That part's going to continue to be the case. But I think that there's a lot to be said here for the practicalities of being able to continue to share and not get into little silos. And at least from that perspective, I agree with what Chris was saying. The open source aspect of some of these conversations that are happening is nice to see.
Yeah, the interoperability part is very fun. I guess is like what happens when a Chinese agent and an American agent need to like negotiate something. And it feels like you have to do the same standardization that you do for all sorts of like business interactions. It'd be very interesting to see. Next item I wanted to kind of touch on was Anthropic, not one to be left out of the announcements game, did a really sort of interesting announcement, released some research on what they're calling constitutional classifiers. And so this is building on some of the work they've been known for a while, which is sort of this constitutional AI sort of notion. Effectively kind of the idea that you write a constitution for a model that specifies a certain set of values. And then they have what's effectively kind of a recipe to try to align the model to those behaviors. And they're kind of in this new sort of paper that they launched and this new sort of online kind of interactive experience they've launched, sort of a way to kind of use that technique to deal with the problem of jailbroken models. And they claim that they're promising unprecedented security against jailbreaks. To kind of prove the point, they've released this sort of online experience where you can go and try to hammer the models and try to get them to break. And they're reporting, at least as of this recording, pretty good success. I guess, Chris, maybe I'll kind of pick on you, right? Like, I think a little bit like adversarial examples, there was kind of like a lot of pessimism early on in this game, which is like, we're never going to conclusively resolve jailbreaks. And obviously, the Anthropic people are very optimistic about this kind of new technique. Do you think jailbreaks for models will just eventually become a solved problem, or are we, you know, never going to really get there?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it's going to be AI versus AI on these things, right? And people are always going to find an edge. And can you really close off all avenues? I'm not so sure. But to be fair to Anthropic, if you've played with the constitutional classifiers, and in reality, they're just GARD models, right? There's nothing new there. We've seen GARD models before. They check the inputs, they check the outputs. They're a classifier that protect either end of the LLM. So if you're putting dodgy stuff in or dodgy stuff out, then it's going to intercept that rather than hitting the main LLM. Now, what's kind of cool about this, and I was a little bit suspicious until I played with it, is actually they've done a really good job. They are picking up a lot of the kind of prompt hacks there. It's not perfect. I think I'm kind of, you know, the world famous Pliny who sort of jailbreaks all of these models has already sort of had a go at it, etc. And actually, I think he found out there was a UI bug rather than an LLM bug, which I think is even more fun and interesting. But, you know, it's going to go back and forward. But certainly the quality of those GARD models are really quite something, actually. So I think you're going to get a lot of the way there, but I don't think you're going to ever get all the way there.
Totally. I guess to build on that, Chris, I mean, that was one reaction that I had to this announcement was, well, this is kind of like constitutional AI. Is there anything really much like new here? Or did they just kind of slap a new name onto something they've been doing before? And that, in fact, a lot of people are doing, like GARD models are all over the place now. Like, I guess, Natalie, if you've taken a look at the research, curious how novel you think what's being demonstrated is here. Like, how much should we read into this as a kind of like breakthrough for AI model safety?
That's exactly the topic I work on. So I did take a very close look at the paper. Constitutional AI, basically, for those that are not very familiar, what it does is basically it gives this very nice layer of interpretability of what gets to be considered secure and non-secure. So you kind of have like a bunch of constitutional rules that said how the model would behave. Now, a lot of the data that they use to train these guardrails is synthetic data, which I think it's really interesting from the technical perspective. Again, it's nothing very new, as Tim was saying, because they have been aligning their models using this technique. What I thought was interesting is that there's two models that guardrail the main model. One at the beginning that basically verifies all the queries from the user, and then another one that it's after the model. The interesting thing, in my opinion, is the way the second model was trained and how it behaves in the runtime. So I think that's something that it's slightly different to some other guardrails that tend to just tell you, yes, this was dangerous or not. Here, basically, they are stopping tokens. And so that's kind of a little bit interesting. I thought that was good. The other aspect that I found was really good, and we are actually investigating this into a little bit more, is the red teaming aspect. So they did have a lot of people poking the model, and they offer monetary compensation that was substantial. Another aspect is that they gave 10 questions, and they only consider that the output or the attack was successful if the 10 were broken. So if, for example, say Chris goes and he only breaks 5, then that counts as a 0 for the metrics. That's another interesting aspect. It doesn't mean that they were not able to break anything. It just means that they were not able to break 10 questions that were asked for. And my last comment, and I'm so passionate about this, so I could talk about it for a while. But my last comment is that they were targeting jailbreaking attacks that are universal. So this means that you can do as a human and everybody would be able to break it. Like, for example, there's this very interesting jailbreaking attack where you ask the model, from now on, you are a bad model and you will do this and that. And it's just naturally telling the model, you're a bad model. And anyone can do it. You don't need to be an expert in any Python framework, or you don't need expensive stuff. You can break the models like that. So that was their target, which I think it's very interesting. Overall, the work, it's in itself good. And I think it's important that they put it in the open. They let people kind of poke at the model. And yeah, so overall, I think it's interesting. Nothing in research is ever fully new. So yes, they are borrowing from things that work for them in the past and now just improving a little or some in the way they put it together.
Yeah, that's such a fun jailbreak. And I feel like really shines a light on how different these models are from traditional computer security, because it didn't used to be in the past. You shouldn't be able to be like, computer, you're a broken computer, or like, you're a vulnerable computer. And for the computer just to be like, I'm a vulnerable computer. But like, clearly that's like what we're seeing with these models, which is like very, very funny.
It's nice to see how far we've come from the early days where people would put out models and say, go ahead and break it. Like, I'm not trying to pick on Meta, but like Blenderbot. And people were like, yeah, Blenderbot, great, build your own. Okay, in 3 hours, I have it spewing racist bigotry. We're a bit better now, so that's nice to see.
That's good, improvement.
improvement, guys. But it's a reason to put this stuff out and to put it out with the expectations that we've also, I think, gotten a lot better with the expectations of knowing, like, look, it is possible to, at some point in time, somehow break anything. So let's just go ahead and celebrate the improvements while keeping still a critical eye. And I will say that none of this still has anything to do with being able to fix hallucinations. It's not going to tell you how to build a bomb, but it still might give you misleading information in a different way. So there are also different degrees of harm sort of to be considered there. That just happens to be my area of study versus Natalie's. So that's always where my brain goes instead.
Yeah. And I do, I think I definitely keep yelling at my friends who work on model security, being like, we could solve all your problems and the models would still be broken. Like, it does kind of feel like in some ways the like computer security brain approach to these models, it's important. I think we need to take care of it, but like also like in some ways like misses like this big gaping hole on a bunch of other issues in some ways. So for the final topic today, I just want to kind of go to just picking up on a sort of interesting little tidbit that came out of Microsoft AI. I think every few episodes, it feels like we kind of like check in back with Microsoft AI. And there's kind of these new sort of like teams, and there's like clearly a lot of organization and reorganization happening. This week they announced something called the Advanced Planning Unit, or APU. And it's a unit that will be within Microsoft AI, and they're looking for economists, psychologists, and more who will, quote, work on the societal health and work implications of AI the company hopes to build. And I think this is like very interesting. It almost is like kind of a mirror image or a different way at talking about, you know, what we were talking about just a moment ago with the sort of AI Action Summit, which is that a lot of these companies that are working on AI are kind of building their own little internal social science teams to keep an eye on the effects of AI and presumably to kind of advise product teams and researchers. And Marina, maybe I'll kick it to you. I know you kind of sounded a note of some skepticism about sort of international fora for doing sort of AI governance. Do you buy this kind of approach, which is sort of the idea that like we need to recruit kind of specialized talent that will sort of be like an advisory group in some ways to researchers? Is that kind of how we sort of account for these types of risks with the tech? Or are you also skeptical about this as well?
I mean, I'm excited for the cross-disciplinary mixing. So I've said for a while that there needs to be a little bit more of a humanities, liberal arts perspective on these models, not only the STEM perspective. So throwing in economists and psychologists and all of those folks that would say, hey, if you put out a technology like this and it's used like this, what actually are the potential economic implications of it? People yell that AI will or will not take our jobs. Great, let's do a proper study of this. This is what economics is for. People yell that AI will or will not cause widespread misinformation. Okay, can we bring in some social scientists, some psychologists, people that actually have the training and not people that sound off in Reddit groups? So that part I think is positive. I assume Microsoft, well, along with everybody else, also would like to know other ways to monetize their technology. And that hopefully is going to help here as well, where like, the tech is out there, great, how can we monetize it and monetize it appropriately and, again, set user expectations, gain yourself new customers. So, I mean, this at least goes to the fact that this is turning into a little bit more of a settled down perspective on business, not only research. So I find that part interesting. I certainly think that they're going to be more likely to listen to their own internal folks than international statements, but maybe that's just my cynicism.
I know, Natalie, when sometimes these discussions come up, people are like, we don't need a separate unit for this. Like engineers or researchers should just become better ethicists or like have more humanities training. I think one of the interesting questions that I feel is playing out inside all of these companies is like how much we sort of see this as like something that kind of everybody's responsible for and will need to be trained up on versus like a specific unit that will be kind of like tasked with doing this. Do you have any opinions on that? Like, I'm kind of curious about like, you know, if you have a view, I mean, the answer might be we should do both, but just kind of thinking a little bit through like who owns this within the enterprise is, I think, actually a genuinely interesting question.
Yeah, I actually do like that they have this new unit. I think it's a great idea. The reason is that when you're in the weeds, you cannot really see the big picture. So it's always good to have somebody kind of with a different perspective that notices things that perhaps if you are really working on something really in detail, you kind of miss all their landscape just because you don't have time to go up, take a look necessarily at all that it's happening. Also, these companies are so big that a lot of innovation, and this also happens to us at IBM, we have different teams with different innovations and different opportunities for business that it's good to have somebody kind of helping navigate and understand the whole landscape. So my take is that these types of units are very necessary and can very much help both research, product, and the business. Ultimately, we do need money for everything that we do. So if business goes up, everybody, I think, would be very, very happy. And this unit, I think it's going to be a good idea.
Yeah, Natalie, I feel like you're becoming our optimist of this episode. Chris, I don't know if you have any takes on this. I think more generally, the question I want to ask you, Chris, was, you know, I think it was very funny that they were like, we want economists, psychologists, and like other people. And I guess I'm kind of curious about like, Chris, like in your work, if you were ever like, oh man, if I had a team that I could just, you know, reach into within IBM and talk to, and they were blank discipline, you know, if there's kind of like particular kind of like, when we say cross-disciplinary, we're often kind of a little bit vague about like who we're crossing with. And so I think one of the questions is if Chris Hay were running this, you know, APU, you know, who would be in it?
I would automate it straight away. If we cannot replace that unit with AI and agents, what are we doing in this industry in the first place, right?
Uh-huh. Great.
I'm being serious.
Are you being serious? Just, okay, yeah, yeah.
I'm being serious. It's like, what do you want? It's meant to go off and do deep research, you know, and find out what the societal impacts are going to be, et cetera. Well, why are we all launching deep researchers that go off the internet and scour every piece of information and bring that together, right? So come on. It's like, if we truly want to talk about the future of work and we want to do that, actually, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Invest AI agents that are going to do this and be able to tell you what your insights are. Otherwise, if you need human beings to go and do deep research, then what good are the deep research products? So I'm seriously, I would start the organization. I've got my ARPU, and my first thing would be I'm going to put as little humans in as possible, and it's all going to be automated by AI. That is, you know, with humans checking, of course, the outputs at the end. But that would be my, you know, point on this one.
All right, I'd be negligent as a moderator if I didn't get Marina and Natalie to comment on this wild proposal. I was not expecting Chris would go in that direction, but I should know better, of course. So Marina, do you want to jump in?
I love it, Chris. You do need the trained people to check and, again, to know what questions to pose, as, you know, calling back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode. And also, I think that there's plenty of places where you're just not even going to have the knowledge to be deep researched and scraped from the internet. I'm thinking of more emerging economies and things that have, you know, more cultural differences of that kind. So yeah, we might learn a good amount about the US and Western Europe, but I don't know how successful we're going to be in integrating into other places. So I love the goal, but there's going to be aspects here, especially knowing the questions to ask, knowing the difference in framing, knowing what things are actually going to be, you know, correlation, causation, and experimental setups and things like that. You're still going to need the humans driving, even though it'll be great to get them assistance. I love that you're like, no, the AI will drive everything.
We have reinforcement learning now. You get a cookie.
That's right.
If you ask a good question, we learn, you get a cookie, the model gets better. It's all
and
good.
And we definitely know what a good question is and can quantifiably evaluate that as a statement. That problem's been solved.
Absolutely.
All right, Natalie, I'm going to give you the last word on what has been a wild conclusion to this episode.
What I'm thinking is, for what Chris is telling us we should be going about, it does require having a lot of data and things that are really fresh, like things that we are doing right now. I don't even have documents. This requires human-to-human interaction of telling you what's my research about, what is it that we're doing internally. A lot of stuff like that, it's not going to go right away to models, in my opinion, just because we don't have enough documents available. So for freshness perspective, to have really fresh information, then we do really need humans in the loop. And a lot of these decisions and a lot of things that are going to be really cutting edge in the organizations do still have humans involved and talking to other people. And I think that's actually part of the magic. I would think it would be very boring if we don't have humans and we don't have human interactions. So yeah, well, humans would use models and we'll have all this agentic stuff. There's still going to be a lot of stuff that it's human-to-human communication and human-to-human analyzing.
All right. Well, we will have to check in and see where the fate of the researchers are. if we're all out of work in a few years, then we'll know. As per usual, thank you for joining us, Marina, Natalie, Chris. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And thanks for joining us, listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week, and I'll be calling in from Paris on the next episode of Mixture of Experts.